This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
David Waldner is a professor at the Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. His latest book is State Building and Late Development. We're honored to welcome him to the program. He joins us on the long line. How are you, David?
I'm doing fine, Coy. How are you today?
Very good. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate you making some time for us.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm watching these headlines of yet more people dying in the Middle East, and Israel's rolling tanks, and the missiles are flying. And I'm like most Americans. I just sort of shake my head, and I'm like, I don't get it. Is it just this kind of thing we're always going to live with? You know, it's been decades of this kind of stuff.
It's been decades. We're coming up into the seventh decade soon, I guess, since a lot of this started.
My Lord. It's just amazing. So you as an expert on the Middle East and somebody who studies this kind of thing every day,
sure.
What are your thoughts when you see these headlines of, you know, Israel's rolling into Gaza?
It makes me feel very old. I've been watching this stuff. I haven't been there watching it from the beginning, but I've been watching some of these wars going back into the 1970s. And I, of course, am very tired of it, and it's very frustrating to watch seemingly some events replaying themselves again and again and again.
Yeah, I can remember just exactly. I mean, we've been here. Haven't we been here before?
Been here.
It's like Groundhog Day.
On the other hand, let me say... It might be inapt to use the word progress, but in the 1970s, the Egyptians and the Syrians were fighting, you know, mass tank battles against the Israelis, and we were seeing tank formations that hadn't been seen since World War II, and that's not happening right now. Israel and Egypt have a formal peace agreement. Israel and Syria do not have a formal peace agreement, but that border is very peaceful. We have seen shifts.
So tell us what happened with Egypt and Syria vis-a-vis Israel. That can the same thing happened with Hamas, and you know, and something obviously happened with the PLO. Can
yes.
These kind of things happen in the future?
Yes. Well, first, I'm really glad you mentioned the PLO, because anybody reading about Hamas today should be saying something like, "They're terrorists. They're vicious anti-Semites. How could anybody live with these people? How could you negotiate with these people?" And yet, 25 years ago, we would have said the same thing about the PLO. Yasser Arafat was hated by people in Israel and people in America. And now we look back. I don't want to say we look back on him fondly, but I think the Israelis would be very happy if he were in charge right now and not Hamas.
Right.
So the first thing to say is people change, attitudes change, things can change. The second thing to say is, you know, in 1967, Israel fought a war with many of its Arab neighbors, with Egypt, with Jordan, and with Syria, and it took over three pieces of territory. It took over the Sinai Peninsula and Gaza Strip from Egypt. It took over the West Bank and East Jerusalem from Jordan, and it took over the Golan Heights in the northeast from Syria. And the Israelis decided that they didn't care that much about the Sinai Peninsula. It was important as a defensive buffer zone, but if they could get a peace treaty with Egypt, they'd happily give that up. They decided they didn't care very much about the Gaza Strip because they didn't have very many settlers there, about 8,000 settlers only, and it was a small area, densely packed with people who are living in despair and poverty. But they cared a lot more about the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and they cared a little bit about the Golan Heights. So, you know, when Israel has said, we don't need to control this territory, they have been able to find an Arab partner to say, okay, we'll negotiate for a full exchange of territory. That is on the table right now. Arab leaders, including leaders of Hamas, have said that they would, in Hamas's case, they won't sign a peace treaty. They don't recognize the legitimacy of the state of Israel, but they've agreed to a long-term ceasefire, a long-term treaty, if Israel will move back to the 1949 borders, the pre-1967 borders, that is to say. But the problem now is that Israel cares very much about this territory. The West Bank and East Jerusalem are areas that have great symbolic and religious and spiritual importance to Israel and the Jewish people there, and in which Israel has placed, all in all, something like 400,000 settlers, and that makes it very much more difficult to create some sort of territorial compromise. In fact, let me give you this statistic.
Yeah, yeah.
If you remember 1993, when under the Clinton administration, Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shook hands on the White House lawn, at the time, there were something like 110,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank, not including East Jerusalem. Well, that number has almost doubled since then, during this time when we've had some sort of peace process going on. So there is this growing integration of a large chunk of the West Bank into Israel itself. Many Israelis think that's as it should be. They think this is land that was given to them by God. Others just say, we won this land, we have every right to it. Disengagement is proving to be extremely difficult, but it's very hard to see how we could reach some sort of permanent agreement without serious disengagement. We've gotten close. Not that long ago, we were fairly close. In early 2001, negotiations were still going on between the PLO and Israel, but nothing since then. And what's happened in the breach is Hamas, which is an organization that was formed in the late 1980s and had been an underground terrorist movement, they've really entrenched themselves in the Gaza Strip. They first won parliamentary elections, and that's worth knowing. This is a group that did come to power right now through free and fair elections that were actually encouraged by the Bush administration and by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. And in summer of 2007, they basically fought a civil war and kicked out the remnants of Yasser Arafat's group, Fatah. So they're deeply entrenched in the Gaza Strip right now, and they have been engaged in what we'd have to call low-level militant activity with Israel over the past 4 or 5 years. I mean, horrific and often terrorist and aimed at civilians, but in the greatest scale of what we've seen in violence in the past, low-level. And Israel's been looking for a way to break the back of Hamas and get them out of the Gaza Strip. And we're seeing that an effort in that direction right now, and it looks like it's not going to succeed.
We're talking with David Waldner. He's a member of the Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics at the University of Virginia and a specialist in Middle East politics. We're honored to have him with us. Interesting, and I want to underscore a point that you made, that Hamas has been duly elected in free elections in a democracy.
They have.
And yet Israel is rolling the tanks to dismantle that. They don't like who was elected.
They don't like, you know, after the installation of democracy in Iraq, there was real sentiment for more democracy promotion in the Middle East. And I think the Bush administration and the Israelis believe that Fatah would win the elections, and this would make them a little bit stronger there. And they rolled the dice, and they lost. And we were very unhappy that Hamas won. Who wouldn't? This is not an organization that I have anyone I know has any sympathy for in terms of their ideology and their attitudes towards Israel. But they won, and what the U.S. and Israel did was immediately following their victory, took steps to get them out of office. We first cut off aid to the Palestinian Authority, and then not long after, in 2007, Israel imposed a blockade on the Gaza Strip. You have to try to get a map of Israel in your mind and think about the Gaza Strip as being a fairly thick splinter along the southern part of the Mediterranean coast as it slopes west towards Egypt. And its main border crossings are actually into Israel proper. And Gaza's economy had been very tightly tied to the Israeli economy, both in terms of providing labor. Many Gazans, many hundreds of thousands of Gazans, in fact, worked in Israel. And also in terms of markets for Gazan goods. And Israel said, well, we're going to put a blockade down. They're going to prevent food and labor and humanitarian assistance from crossing the borders. And in doing so, we're hoping to, in a sense, cripple the population so much that they will oust Hamas for us. And that was a theory that didn't work. It's a theory that is often tried and seldom succeeds. And Hamas, in its efforts to break the blockade, has on more than one occasion launched rockets into southern towns in Israel. And for the most part, their lethality is low, but of course, if you live in a place like in a southern town of Israel, the fact that I say these are not very lethal weapons doesn't make you feel any better, because people do die or are injured on occasion.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking with David Waldner of UVA's Department of Politics. So, as I understand it, David, the connection between Hamas in Gaza and Iran is very real. Those connections do exist, and Iran is sending money to Hamas, and it's no secret.
Yes, although I would say the strongest external backer of Hamas is Saudi Arabia, our ally. But it's a slightly tangled web, and Iran is certainly a backer, a diplomatic backer, a political backer, not an incredibly large military backer. I mean, when Israel fought against Hezbollah in the north in Lebanon, they were fighting against Iranian weapons in many respects, and people had been trained by the Iranians, and that doesn't seem to be the case very much against Hamas, and Hamas doesn't have the same capacity Hezbollah did.
Interesting.
But that's sort of external support is there.
It's Saudi support, though. That's very interesting. And it reminds me, of course, that one thing that we always should keep in mind, that those guys that crashed those planes on 9/11, most of them were Saudis.
Most of them were Saudi. That's right.
Our ally.
That's right. The lines of alliance and of enmity are very tangled at times. Absolutely right. That said, the Saudi government, for the most part, has been very much on our side and very much themselves embattled against the radical Islamists. But sometimes we ally with people who don't always see eye to eye with us on everything.
Yeah, David, let's pull back for a minute, if we can, and take a larger view here. You write a lot about state development and how nation states are born and which ones prosper and why, and which ones perhaps fall prey to terrorist control and why. Very, very fascinating stuff. And without getting too academic, if you can, within the context of the collapse of the British Empire, and you know, we just see so many hotspots when the Brits pulled out, whether it's you know, India, Pakistan, or Iraq, and certainly all around the Middle East. Give us your thoughts about this subject, about what we've seen in the end of British colonialism.
Sure.
What's happening?
They used to say the sun will never set on the British Empire because it encircled the globe so effectively. Well, the sun set, and then a terrible storm came in and really, really beat people up badly. When the British left, they left in behind them a couple of things. First, the states they left behind, the governments and their capacity to do things like tax people and administer societies, et cetera, tended to be very weak. They didn't really have any capacity that we would think of. Second, they did tend to have militaries left behind. That was one organization that was built up during the colonial period. And third, the borders that were built, the borders that were set up often in a very arbitrary way, separated ethnic groups, brought together groups that didn't necessarily like one another, or brought together groups that, under British control, came to hate one another. And so you had, you know, in the 1920s, Winston Churchill drawing lines on the map and creating places like Iraq and creating places like Transjordan. And these were places that didn't have a history of being independent states and didn't have a lot of administrative capacity and contained groups that increasingly came to mistrust one another and view one another with hostility and tended to have powerful militaries. So if you have a weak state and a very new and ineffective parliamentary government but a strong military, the military tends to take control. You know, if the parliament has legitimacy of millions of people on its behalf, then the military will go back to its ballots. But if the parliament is seen as being corrupt, as ineffective, et cetera, then militaries are well placed to step in. So plenty of places from Pakistan to Egypt to Iraq, you had various forms of military rule, of course, of rule. And they weren't very good at governing their own societies or developing their own economies, but what they could do during the Cold War was play the Soviets and the Americans off one another. And Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt was the master at this. He'd go to the Americans and ask for something, and we wouldn't give him very much, so he'd very publicly get on a plane and go to Moscow, and the Americans would rethink, and we should give him something else. And so here you have these military governments. They're ineffective, but they stay in power for long periods of time. And after a while, they're so damned corrupt, and they're seen as being puppets of external forces that groups of people become deeply angry at them. And in the 1980s, we started to see the rise of these new Islamist movements. And it's worth pointing out what made these Islamist movements, these radical Islamic fighters, so new and so different from their grandparents and their great-grandparents, was that they felt they had the mandate to attack their own governments and overthrow their own governments, which they saw as being deeply antithetical to their religious beliefs. And so a lot of the convulsions we're seeing, when we think about Islamic terrorism, we worry about attacks in the West, et cetera, but the vast majority of those attacks are actually against their own governments. And at the same time, territorial disputes persist. At times I scratch my head and say, how could people fight all these decades over Kashmir? How could people fight all these decades over relatively barren pieces of land?
Yeah.
But people are able to attach symbolic importance to things that don't seem to have a great deal of material worth.
And from an anthropological perspective, they have defined their society as fighting.
Yes and no. But let me step back for one second, because one thing we tend to forget about is even when Hamas and Israel are fighting, they actually speak to one another. They have third-party negotiations. They have informal negotiations. They make one side will say we'll do this, and they negotiate. And so it's not as if they're just constantly launching rockets and letting the tanks roll. That's what we tend to see on the news. We don't tend to see when there's behind-the-scenes negotiations. But the fact of the matter is, the outline of some sort of settlement is there. And maybe a new American administration will take this as being something a high priority topic and push for this, because it's even with a group like Hamas, and let's not kid ourselves, we're talking about terrorists, we're talking about people who have a very militant Islamic view of the world, even they have laid out the conditions under which they would have a long-term ceasefire with Israel.
Would they accept the Israeli state?
Probably not, but on the other hand, I could say to you, so what? If I'm Israel and this group will not attack me anymore and the things they want back from me are ultimately seen as being acceptable, then I could say, A, even if they don't like me, they're not going to attack me because I'm militarily superior. B, militants mellow out as they get older sometimes, not always, but sometimes. And C, the Palestinian people as a whole, going by public opinion survey and et cetera, are deeply in favor of a two-state solution. And if Hamas negotiated some sort of long-term treaty, they might not accept an Israeli state, but the Palestinians might hold them to it and might even remove them if the Hamas did not seem like they were going to comply with their wishes. So, as repugnant as Hamas often is, we need to not lose sight of the fact that when people are acting militantly, they say all sorts of awful things, but negotiations often follow wars. It's not unheard of. That's often when we need the negotiations most.
My guest is David Waldner. He's a member of the Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. His book, State Building and Late Development, is now available in paperback. David, before I let you go, I want to ask you one final question. What is it you think that Americans don't get, or what is it we don't understand about the Middle East that we really should understand, especially if we're going to affect any kind of change as a world leader?
That's a great question, and I'm a political scientist, so let me give you a sort of political science answer. We don't understand that the Arabs are rational people. We tend to notice them most when they're fighting. We tend to notice them most when they're engaging in acts of terrorism. When we hear them speak, they're often saying things like, we declare a war on Israel, or we declare a war on the Crusaders, etc. And we come to believe that they're just religious militants who want nothing more than to fight and maybe even to be martyrs. And all of that, there's some truth to all of that, but underneath it all, they're rational people, and I mean that in two senses. One, they have a set of grievances which are reasonable at times, which we could give some legitimacy to. We could say, okay, I can understand how someone would be upset about that. And two, they make some type of calculation. They're not always fighting. Sometimes they say it's better to try to talk right now. Let me give you one quick example of this. The Hamas and Israel had a ceasefire going back to June of 2008. During the time of that ceasefire, which was not perfect, Israel maintained its blockade. It maintained the economic blockade of Gaza. And Gaza, in return, did not return an Israeli soldier they captured earlier. So it wasn't a perfect ceasefire. The ceasefire is coming to an end, and it's clear that Hamas started to think like this. The ceasefire as it was didn't work very well. So Hamas said, we could keep the status quo, have a ceasefire again, and starve ourselves to death. We could have some sort of brinkmanship. We could do a limited engagement in the hope that Israel won't overreact and that the international community will then step in and try to broker some better arrangement for us, or we could have an all-out engagement. And I think they said that that was their order of preferences. They didn't want the status quo. They were starving. They were getting nothing. They would prefer to have had a limited engagement to a large-scale engagement, but they would have preferred either one of them to do in the status quo. And in that sense, they were rational calculators. They were trying to figure out what was happening. The Israelis, on their part, I think, obviously are also rational calculators. I think they miscalculated.
Yeah.
I think the Israelis thought that by this point, Hamas would be gone and Fatah would come back to Gaza and something could happen. And you know what? It didn't happen. So neither the blockade or a major military incursion have gotten rid of Hamas. And that puts Israel in a bind.
Right.
Because where do they go next?
And if they're rational and calculating, all the more reason to believe in the fact that they may be able to negotiate something that might benefit us, and also all the more reason to believe not to underestimate their ability to inflict real harm and to cause real danger and terror.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So here's my prediction for you. Sometime in the next 20 years, there will be a solution to this, and we'll look back and we'll say to ourselves, heck, we could have done that 20 years ago, Why did we wait so long?
David Waldner is with the Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics at the University of Virginia, and his book, State Building and Late Development, is now available in paperback. David, I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.